Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of the Learning Resources Center in the Audiovisual Division on the campus. The Encyclopedia of the First Amendment is our topic today. It's a handsome two-volume set that is out from CQ Press, that's Congressional Quarterly Press, available at Congressional Quarterly, CQPress.com, also in your local bookstores and on Amazon.com, and anywhere you can buy books. It's a reference material that is going to be used in libraries, high school libraries, college libraries across the country, to help students learn more about the people, legal cases, and events that help to further illuminate and shape our understanding of the very First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And two of the three editors of this compilation are here with us today to talk about it. Dr. John Vile is the Dean of the University Honors College and recent past chair of the Department of Political Science. David Hudson is an adjunct professor of political science here and also a scholar at the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. The third editor is Dr. David Schultz of Hamline University in Minnesota, and with budget cuts, we just didn't have the money to fly him down here to be on this program. In the interest of full disclosure, you should also know that I worked on the encyclopedia doing administrative work, and I also wrote five of the essays. So this all falls under the category of shameless self-promotion. However, we genuinely think, that this is worth it. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, how did you find out about this project? Was it your idea, or did CQ Press contact you, or did you contact them? How were the arrangements made?
I'm not sure I remember. I believe David Hudson and I had edited an Encyclopedia of Civil Liberties, and I believe that I came up with the proposal, talked to him about it, and then realized that David Hudson was nearby and knew more about the First Amendment than either of us. And so the threesome, if I recall, submitted the proposal to a number of different publications, and CQ was the first to bite.
And it ended up having more than 1,200
entries? I think it's about 1,400, just over 1,400 entries, yes.
From more than, 200 scholars?
About 225, something like that.
Yeah,
yes,
with 200 right. Scholars and me.
Yes. Well, whatever.
Okay. David, did John just ask you to be the co-editor of this? How did you get involved?
I believe Dr. Vile contacted me. I've always wanted to work on something with him because I hold him in such high regard, and he had helped me write a scholarly book on the Rehnquist Court. And during the course of his helping me with that work, we had talked about the desirability of collaborating on something to do with the First Amendment. And I think he actually wrote the proposal that CQ accepted. And I think we originally may have met at the We the People competition.
We did.
So it's Middle Tennessee State University.
In California, wasn't it? Oh, well, no, then we met in the conference in California after that.
That's right. We met at the conference in California, and then MTSU, for the last several years, has been generous enough to host a program sponsored by the Center for Civic Education called We the People, which teaches young people about the values of the Constitution and Bill of Rights.
But up until now, has there ever been really a, for lack of a better word, one-stop shopping place to find such an in-depth trove of knowledge about the First Amendment in either of your memories?
There are some reference books on free expression. Certainly there are plenty of books about, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of press, and another passel of books on either or both of the clauses related to religion. But to my knowledge, this is the first sort of comprehensive encyclopedic A to Z treatment that deals with all the different provisions within the First Amendment.
Literally A to Z. It's Adventist to John Peter Zenger,
yes,
if you will. And a foreword by Tennessean publisher emeritus John Siegenthaler to boot.
We're very pleased to have had him do that, yes.
Uh, I'm going to ask you a question now to which I already know the answer, but in the interest of informing our listeners, how did you guys obtain contacts with so many different scholars from all across the country and even a few from overseas?
Should I take that one, or you?
I think you should.
Okay. Well, we actually tried something that was a little unique. We started with a number of listservs, and David Schultz probably did more of that than any of us. And then we actually took a proposal to the American Political Science Association, and at the CQ table had a desk where people who were interested could, you know, had a little description of it and could sign up if they were interested in contributing. And then, you know, we followed our personal contacts and just sort of took it from there.
And this question goes to the very heart of your job, David. It would seem totally obvious to me to that it shouldn't even be asked, why the First Amendment? Mm-hmm. But can you put into your own words the need to constantly renew and review our history with this particular aspect of the law, and the necessity to keep it fresh and vital in American democracy?
Well, certainly the First Amendment, the first 45 words of the Bill of Rights, essentially serves as our blueprint for personal liberty. And if you look at the course of the history of the First Amendment, it's often been quite fragile, particularly in times of war. Much of our history has been sad episodes of the curtailment of civil liberties. And we also find in even modern-day surveys that a lot of public school students and even adult citizens know far too little about the First Amendment and what freedoms it protects. So I think the necessity of this work is shown by, to be frank, a lack of knowledge about the First Amendment and the freedoms that it protects.
Why is that? Why is it that kids in K-12 don't really get this lesson? Is it that people have a hard time relating the first 45 words to concrete examples in the kids' everyday lives, or is it that it's just been overlooked? You tell me.
One possible reason could be the obsession with educational standards, which often focus on math and science and reading, and the social sciences often seem to be neglected. During the whole debate over No Child Left Behind, I think the social sciences generally were given short shrift. You know, I can say from my own personal experience in schooling, I wasn't taught much, if anything, about the First Amendment. So I certainly think that this book hopefully will fill in some of the gaps that exist.
One of the things you sometimes find is that people will be committed in the abstract to freedom of speech or press or religion, but they don't necessarily connect that with someone saying something they disagree with or worshiping in a way that they don't approve of. So
there's a desire to avoid controversy in K-12, to avoid possible parental friction, or like, for example, I doubt anybody's going to be talking to kids about Lenny Bruce and George Carlin because they used words that some of their parents might object to. But those are two entries in the encyclopedia, and justifiably so.
Yes. Another entry in the encyclopedia is Nat Hentoff, and Mr. Hentoff has a book title that I think accurately sums up many people's disconnect between the real and the ideal with respect to the First Amendment, and that is free speech for me, but not for thee.
Right. Which, of course, goes, you know, our American founders, we probably the greater focus of the book is probably more on expression and press and speech, but a good bit of the book deals with the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, and, you know, the Puritans came to the United States for religious freedom, but it wasn't freedom for everybody. It was freedom for them to practice their religion as they please, and they didn't have a lot of compunction about hanging or exiling Baptists or Quakers or people that differed from them.
Or for a more contemporary example, the freedom to allow the Ku Klux Klan to march down Main Street when it is this organization that strikes fear in the hearts of any African-American old enough to remember the era of beatings and lynchings and that sort of thing.
Sure.
comes into play there as well. So it's not just about the conflict between the conflicts over scatological language or Janet Jackson's breast being revealed on national television. There are life and death issues that are associated with the First Amendment, to be very grave about it, aren't there? Give me an example.
Life and death issues, oh goodness. how much are we paying her for this interview?
Well, if you don't...
Certainly during wartime, many people, I don't know if it's necessarily life and death, but people have certainly been in prison for criticizing the government. During the Adams administration, when the Sedition Acts were passed, close to 20 people, I believe, were imprisoned and would have stayed there for quite a while had Thomas Jefferson not come into office and pardoned them. So certainly that would be a fairly significant example. You don't have to go, far outside the United States to find nations where people are, in fact, still burned out of their houses or thrown in jail for religious beliefs that they have. So it's, we're what do we say, always a generation away from barbarism. Well, same is true for most of our freedoms.
What about the Palmer raids?
Sure.
The freedom of assembly. People got beaten up and thrown in jail.
Another example are the Jehovah Witnesses after the United States Supreme Court's decision in 1940 in Minersville School District versus Gobitis, which upheld a Pennsylvania flag salute law. And there was a wave of violence perpetrated against Jehovah Witnesses, which led to one of the most remarkable turnabouts in United States Supreme Court history with the 1943 decision in West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett.
And while it's not exactly life-threatening, it certainly was career-threatening. We did go through a period of rather insidious dirty deeds called the McCarthy era in this country, where both freedom of speech and freedom of association were under assault from the government itself.
That's true.
What did you guys, learned though you may be, learn that you didn't know before in the course of all researching all those many essays that you wrote for this encyclopedia?
I had no idea there were this many Supreme Court cases. Every time we get an essay in, it seems like we'd find a reference to a case that we didn't know about. They just sort of multiplied. The more we got, the more we found.
And you went back beyond the Supreme Court, didn't you?
We did some
lower court cases that were essential.
Most of what this U.S. Supreme Court has said about the First Amendment has been since 1925, because prior to that time, for the most part, the court did not apply the Bill of Rights to the states. So we went back and found quite a few 19th century cases, some late 18th century, that would deal with things like blasphemy or pornography or libel or those kind of things. And I think it provided a context that no comparable book has provided. We'll see what the reviewers think.
Dr. Vowles being modest, because the we is primarily he.
Oh, well, in the 19th century, I tend to enjoy that century. Almost as good as the 18th.
And that's before you get into your James Madison.
That's right.
There is something called libel tourism these days, where some people who are in the public eye in this country, they go overseas where the like say Britain, for example, where the standard of proof is not as high, to try to sue somebody for libel. And in this country, the Supreme Court's decisions have established a sort of standard that a public figure that has to be met in order to successfully sue someone from libel. Could you talk a little bit about that, David?
Well, sure. In 1964, the United States Supreme Court constitutionalized libel law in a case called New York Times Company versus Sullivan, which involved an editorial advertisement that was printed in the New York Times in December of 1960 by the Committee to Defend Dr. Martin Luther King, and it talked about civil rights abuses and violations committed by Southern violators. There were some errors in that editorial advertisement, and the net result was that L.B. Sullivan, who was a city commissioner in charge of the police department, successfully sued the Times and four individual clergymen in Alabama state courts and got a rather large jury verdict, I believe $500,000 or something to that effect. And up until that point, until the United States Supreme Court weighed in, states were largely free to create libel laws free from constitutional restraints. But Justice William Brennan wrote an opinion for the United States Supreme Court in which he said that, this issue must be understood against the backdrop of a, quote, profound national commitment that debate on public issues should be robust, uninhibited, and wide open, and may well include vehement and caustic attacks upon public officials. And that with respect to public officials, there has to be a higher standard of proof, which we refer to in the law as actual malice, which means that simply because the press makes an error, that's not enough to impose liability when they're writing about a public official or a public figure. You have to show that the press acted with actual malice.
And that's hard to prove.
Knowing falsity or acting in reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity of a statement.
If I can put in another advertisement, our mock trial case this year deals with an alleged libel of a public official, and so we call them by different names, but we're basically applying the actual malice standard from the Sullivan case to that event.
John is a longtime coach of MTSU's mock trial team, which is off to its best start ever.
It is. We came in one of three teams that had a 7-1 record at University of St. Louis 2 weeks ago.
Since you are the constitutional law scholar, talk a little bit, John, about the ever-present balancing act between fair press and free press and fair trial.
Well, that's a little trickier in that, you know, the Constitution doesn't do the balance for us. We have a guarantee of free press, free expression. We have another guarantee of due process. And by and large, I think in recent years, the court, if they can find an alternative to, especially to prior restraint of publication or to gag orders, they generally try to do it. They would prefer to change the venue of a trial, sequester the juries, have a larger jury pool, do just about everything that they can rather than tell people that, or you know, tell news people that they cannot publish results of trials. And that's probably the right tack to take on it. But obviously, you know, there are very few people in American history, I would say, who think that the First Amendment is completely absolute. Hugo Black is one who said that it was absolute, although even in his case he tended to restrict, his notion of speech wasn't wide enough to include symbolic speech, with which most people would say it does. So almost everybody, you know, you can think of an example somewhere where some restriction of speech might be warranted, but usually we look at it in the United States as a last resort rather than, you know, as a place to begin.
Do you have a problem with cameras in the courtroom?
No. I think in the case of the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, it's not likely to happen absent the Supreme Court justices agreeing to it. So I guess there's a problem with it in the sense that it's not authorized. I do think that there are some cases, and I think the O.J. case, the original O.J. case, could be an example of where coverage on a day-to-day basis ultimately resulted in some courtroom behavior that would otherwise not have happened. I do think people sometimes play to the cameras when they're there, and I think judges really need to be careful in terms of, you know, there are a couple, is it Billy Sol Estes, Sam Shepard, there have been some cases in American history where when the cases got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the court had to void the ruling on the basis that, you know, the media was just so influential that the persons really did not get a fair trial.
With regard to the advancements in technology, television certainly, radio and TV both have certainly changed.
They're not quite as intrusive as they used to be. In the Shepherd case, if I recall, people were literally just almost stumbling over the microphones and the cords.
They hounded the man to death.
Yes.
They almost literally hounded him to his grave in terms of the nervousness and the stress. But the First Amendment interpretations have had to be done over and over and over again with radio and television and the advent of the new technology coming along. Do you want to address yourself to how this applies to the internet, David, where people get away with saying darn near anything, regardless of whether it's nice or civil or even true, as yet not subject to a lot of regulation?
Well, the United States Supreme Court did in June 26, 1997, Reno versus ACLU, did strike down Congress's first attempts at regulating speech on the internet. It struck down portions of something called the Communications Decency Act, which criminalized the online transmission of patently offensive or indecent online communication. And in the words of the late attorney Bruce Ennis, sort of gave the internet its legal birth certificate. We are seeing an upsurge, however, in online libel cases where people believe that the internet is a legal free zone, and it is not. And so we're seeing a couple developments in this area. One is if somebody gets on the internet and engages in anonymous speech that's defamatory, how do we protect the honored First Amendment right of anonymous communication, but also recognize an individual's right to seek redress through traditional tort remedies like defamation? And the lower courts are struggling with crafting different standards to address that balance.
Cyberbullying has become a trend lately. Tweeners and teens get on the internet and
their parents sometimes as well.
and trash their peers and really traumatize kids and sometimes, you know, ruin their reputations. And it's an extraordinary thing. What about bringing the First Amendment to the level of the average person so that it is not legally abstract? There was a case that you recently wrote about, David, about the young man in a school district in New York who was assigned to create a poster explaining what he had learned about environmentalism in class. His first attempt was thrown out because it had some religious imagery in it. His second attempt also had religious imagery in it, but it was people taking garbage and throwing it in the trash can, I believe, outside a church, and a picture of Jesus there saying, "This is my world," or something to that effect. And the teacher would not accept it. And then it went through several levels of court, and at the last level, they finally said, "Well, the teacher has the right to reject this because it was not germane, not because it has Jesus in it, but just because it was not germane to the assignment that was given."
Yeah, that's the Peck versus Baldwinsville Central School District is a case that began with this kid was a kindergartner, and he may graduate college before it winds its way through the appellate process.
But it'll be in our second edition, right?
That's right. I do think that case does implicate one of the most fundamental First Amendment principles, and that is that generally the government may not discriminate against speech based on viewpoint. We refer to it in First Amendment terms as the principle against viewpoint discrimination. That I think Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote that if the First Amendment means anything, or above all else, it means that the government may not restrict speech because of its message, ideas, subject matter, or content. Mm. In today's realm, particularly in the public schools, there is a feeling by many that there is actually viewpoint discrimination committed against religious expression, in that public school officials are censoring religious-based expression because of the religious viewpoint of the speech. It's that what led to the congressional passage of the Equal Access Act. But I think one thing about this encyclopedia is that not only do we have, you know, some United States Supreme Court cases that some may find sort of erudite or you know,
arcane.
Perhaps on the obscure side. But we really take fundamental First Amendment principles and concepts and try to explain those.
Like viewpoint discrimination, context.
In a very reader accessible manner.
I think
we succeed by and large. And not only do we have cases, but we have events of popular culture. You mentioned George Carlin. We have entries on George Carlin, who sadly passed away recently. We have entries on Lenny Bruce, who you also mentioned earlier. We have entries on attorneys who argued many First Amendment cases before the United States Supreme Court. And we have many entries on different religious groups or denominations that have found themselves the frequent litigants in
Adventist, Jehovah's Witnesses, Baptist,
controversies.
The Pentagon Papers case, for those of you who remember back that far. United States versus Nixon, I believe, is in there trying to get the tapes.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court decision on that during Watergate, trying to get the access to the tapes in the Oval Office. I believe it's written so that it's very accessible to anyone with a high school education. Wouldn't you say so, John?
At the same time,
it maintains its scholarly credentials.
Well, and for those needing some help, I mean, there's an extensive index that CQ helped us with, but then we also have we have two different tables of contents. One that just goes through A through Z, and then another that does it by subject matter. So if somebody's doing a research paper and they want to know about cases involving student speech, there's a special section on that, as many others.
And there are major entries written by top-notch scholars that provide broad overviews of certain topics. They are in the front of Volume 1, are they not?
Are
or close to the front.
Basically, each of the separate provisions of the First Amendment, and then we have some generally on First Amendment and the rest of the world, sort of the future of the First Amendment, how the First Amendment came to be applied against the states, and then of course John Siegenthaler's essay, which deals more generally with, you know, how the Bill of Rights and particularly the First Amendment came to be.
Government intervention. It is long stuck in the craw of broadcasters that the Federal Communications Commission can tell radio and television what to do, but nobody in the government can tell the print media what to do. Now, that's a broad brush, and it's not, you know, that's a generalization. But if for the most part, it's true. Do you come down on the side of more or less government intervention, or is it more nuanced than that, case-by-case basis?
I think it's probably more nuanced. I mean, I don't think, other than having obviously a strong commitment to the subject or we wouldn't have bothered with it, mm-hmm. I don't think that we consider the book to be a book of advocacy. Mm-hmm. It's a book for somebody who would be interested in either side to see what the precedents are and try to understand what the basis for each one of them would have been.
And I don't think government intervention is a title in and of itself, but there are lots and lots of different cases that deal with aspects of government intervention. In the time we have left, what was working on this like for you guys? Fun, exhausting, frustrating, all of the above?
I think by and large it was a labor of love and a love of learning. Your question, I thought, was a very good one when you asked what do we learn. It really was a learning process. I did not know there were so many 19th century cases until Dr. Vile unearthed them all and wrote about them. I didn't know about a lot of these litigants who argued so many cases before the United States Supreme Court. I mean, there's just so much out there.
Mm-hmm. And actually, just cataloging all the laws, that was sort of something we came to a little bit later, but most, you know, there haven't been that many, but the laws, particularly those related to internet and that kind of thing, we try to have some description so that somebody trying to look them up could find a place to get them.
And it is extensively... not to say archived. It is extensively indexed so that you can find just about anything on just about any subject. I had a lot of fun. As Robin Williams says, learning is a natural high. Why do you think Einstein's hair looks like that? The Encyclopedia of the First Amendment from CQ Press. Dr. John Vile, David Hudson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Jenna Logue. This is MTSU On the Record. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can download the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.